So I'm recording OBS, which is recording my screen and your audio. And I'm also recording myself on this, Audio Hijack. And you're also recording the Zoom call. So we should be covered.
We should be covered, yeah.
Okay. So there's... As you know, I do a lot of this, I participate in this thing called Pasta Gang.
Yep.
And as you also know, a lot of that stuff I do in Pasta Gang, sort of, a lot of the ideas that I bring to the table can be rooted back all the way back to robust first computing. So I thought it would be nice to share some of those links back to other people. Yeah, and also just to have a chat.
All right. Well, I'm fine with that. I see your Pasta Gang stuff happening on the Fediverse, and what was the latest new album that just came out today or something yesterday?
get political.
Get political. Well, and it looked like it had a picture of Bird looking up or something on the cover.
Yeah. So like the crows, a crow is like a very common sound effect that people use in Pasta Gang things. So it's, yeah, the crow.
It's thematic, I guess.
And also crows are sort of like associated with death, and death is often associated with
the sort of Nevermore, Edgar Allan Poe type thing. Okay, all right.
So I thought, I've occasionally like written about, you know, how certain themes can and root back to robust first computing, but I don't know if anyone read it or not. But another way we can...
Not your job. Your job.
Not my job.
Put it out there. Their job to read it.
Exactly. So obviously there's this podcast that anyone can make an episode for, and the previous episode actually came out today, which I didn't realize was going to happen. But
podcast episode 6, I saw that or something in the list of 24-hour events or whatever.
That you
just posted about.
Yes. So I thought this was going to be episode 6, but not. It will probably be episode 7, unless another one comes out.
And then it might be episode 12.
You are listening to the Pasta Gang podcast, episode 7.
Let's introduce ourselves.
Okay.
My name is Lou. You've seen me
or
before.
Luke.
Or Luke, either's fine. Forgetting that.
Gotta forget. Yeah. Well, is it still true? Or are you more on Lou these days?
No, it's still true. It's just like takes up breath to say, you know.
Yeah. We only have so many breaths in this world.
Exactly. And I'm a keen Pasta Ganger. And I'm here with my co-author.
Right.
Dave Ackley. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, folks. My name's Dave. I am a computer nerd since the 1970s. I've been actually a machine nerd much longer than that. I mean, my first fond memories are preschool in the playroom at our little house, playing with a set of blocks, a classic set of blocks that are in all those ratios of squares and everything like that. And without realizing it, I was learning, what would stand and what wouldn't stand, what you could put it next to each other and how high you could build it and what friction would do and what friction wouldn't do, all of that stuff. And I now realize, looking back on it, I was building little machines. I was building little machines out of blocks. And then after a while, I was also at this great game where you'd build the tallest thing you could, and then you'd get under the table and throw blocks at it until it all fell down and made a terrific racket. And that was a machine that was super fun.
I think I know that game.
Yeah, it's a great game. It's a great game. I invented it all by myself. And I've been building machines like that ever since. And I got lucky enough. My parents were willing to indulge all my stupid hobbies and chemistry sets. I tried to build things and rockets and electrical motors and little robots and things. I mean, all in the versions that you could have in the 60s and the 70s, which were pretty wimpy, although the rockets were cool. And then I came into computers, and computers, it was so easy to get a computer to do something that I spent a whole career doing computer stuff in academia and industry, and now out on my own trying to. I mean, my problem with, I've been making machines for so many decades, I get bored with every machine I make, and I have to make a machine that's different. I have to make a machine that works differently. And a lot of the machines that I used to make, it's like, yeah, I get it. That's fine. I know how they work. I still remember how blocks falling down works, but it's not as much fun as it used to be. And the same thing happened with regular old computers. So I started trying to make different kind of computers that would do things that I did not expect, that would do things that would surprise me or be cool in some new way.
Okay, yeah, and there might be hints of like how that links to some of the sort of distributed pasta gang jamming that happens already. But I guess when you're talking about building machines, like I know, and anyone who's read our paper would know that when you talk about a machine nowadays, you're. The way me and you understand a machine can also be like an organism is a kind of a weird kind of machine that doesn't have nuts and bolts, but has veins and neurons and
muscles and bones, levers and everything.
And a few screws, maybe even a few screws.
Maybe even a few screws, although those probably were not probably not original equipment.
Right, right.
Like that. Yes, absolutely. And I mean, for me, one of the things, you know, I've been trying to I was trying to make sense of the world. I've just been trying to make sense of the universe. And that's been ongoing. And the building machines is just what I do, what I enjoy. So I've been doing that as much as I can. And I've been very lucky to make a career out of doing it in my own weird way. But I've also been trying to make sense of the big picture of things. And where it lands me is this idea that living things, creatures, you and I, roaches, everything in between, are best understood as a kind of machine. That a machine is something that is matter organized in a certain way. A machine doesn't happen at random. A machine is built, and once it's built, it has properties that the individual pieces didn't have, and it needs to have a power source of some sort. Maybe it's a one-shot power source, like the solid rocket motors that I did when I was a kid. You shoot them up, they're done. Or there could be something that, you know, you plug in the wall and it goes over, but it needs a power source. It needs matter arranged in a certain way so that it can do something, so that it can move, so that it can do work in the world. And to me, that seems like the basic, you know, cutting away everything, cutting away all our vanities, the most basic notion of, well, but geez, that's what living systems do. They're arrangements of matter in the world to have energy supply that move and work and so forth. I think, you know, we need to begin if we want to make sense of things. We don't have to make sense of things, but if we want to, then we should start out by thinking there's some distinct relationship between living things and machines, rather than thinking they are like opposites.
And you know what I'm realizing? We're kind of replaying our paper a little bit here. But
hey, the great stories have to be told over and over and over again. It took me decades to appreciate that.
Let's find out if it's a great story. I think it's a good story, because I think maybe I think it's good to start with our paper, because that's I guess maybe one of our strongest like connections to each other. I guess I would encourage the viewer or listener to, if you find those ideas provocative or interesting, go read our paper, and I'll put a link to it. Because of course, like my reaction back then and now, like hearing you say that, is like, I'm like, whoa, you know, like
Earth to Dave.
Like, yeah. I'm like, you know, I see it. So obviously, you know, my initial gut reaction to that is I see what you're saying. However, it feels very cold-hearted to me to view people as machines, right?
As right.
But like, if you read our paper, we sort of go more into like, oh no, we know we're not, we don't want to make it, I don't know. We don't want, we want to do this in a, I would say we want to do this in a warm, for warm-hearted reasons.
You yes. know,
to be able yes. to view ourselves and the people around us as part of a bigger ecosystem, like to understand the system of the ecosystem, you know, more as a machine with processes and things like that.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, is, do you want to say anything else about that?
Well, just that it's great that we keep going around on this, and it's great that you keep reminding me that, man, I don't feel like a machine. Man, it feels like it's a real nasty, horrible, cold way to look at the universe. And, you know, my reaction is is that's just the fault of the wimpy machines we have these days. And that, you know, if we are saying that living organisms are machine-like in the sense that they're arrangements of matter with power supplies that do things, then we could say, well, in order to make sense of this, we have to understand machines in a much more sympathetic or empathetic way than we have understood machines before, rather than understanding people and life in a more cold-hearted, mechanical way. But again, just like it's mentioned in the paper, there are these two views of us as these immanent beings with souls and us as these piles of meat that need to get the drugs from the doctor. And both of those views are important. Both of those views count. It's just, you know, at any given moment, we'd rather think of ourselves as an imminent, wonderful, glowing being with a soul and less like a pile of meat that's starting to turn like that. And that's fine. This is not saying that we must spend all our lives, every moment, thinking, you're just a machine. Ah, you're just a machine. Yeah. You need some oil or whatever.
Some coffee.
But that we need to be able to go back and forth between those two views, the mechanical view and the self view, the I exist view.
Yeah. So it's like... part of this view of viewing people as machines is also like expanding and I don't want to say humanizing, but yeah, and it like maybe it humanizing the idea of what a machine is. It's not just changing
we're broadening the idea of machinery a lot.
Yeah.
And people say, well, why do that? We have perfectly good notions of what machines are. And my response is, well, you know, but I kept getting into trouble, finding all these edge cases. Is this thing a machine or is it not a machine? And what is the crisp edge when something stops being? And in the end, I just gave up and I said, no, we're going to have to say it's like a mechanical spectrum of more and more simple and rigid at one end to more and more subtle and lifelike at the other end, but they're all going to be machines. And we are going to have to make a distinction on a case-by-case basis. Do I want to treat this particular pile of matter as a living thing that I can fall in love with, or do I want to treat it as something that I could sit on or cook for dinner?
And fall in love with. No.
And perhaps also fall in love with its taste, yeah, or anything. So that's it. And again, I feel like people mishear these things because they say, well, if I have to view everything that way, if I have to view everything that way all the time, that sounds like a really cold way to do it. And I want to back away from that immediately. I want to say, no, this is one choice. This is one way. And it's one really important way, just like medicine can be really important. And it's looking at us in a very mechanical way.
I'm just writing down conversation points that we could... because keep popping up, and we may not get them all done. But okay, I think that's a pretty good teaser of the paper.
And the paper is very readable. Go take a look; you'll see.
It feels weird. Like, okay, maybe this is something worth getting out of the way first. Is that like I didn't plan for this, but it's like, oh look, we're using this Pasta Gang podcast to advertise something that's
I not see,
Pasta
yes.
Gang, right?
Right.
But we are Pasta Gang, so we are allowed to do that. So you know, we decided.
I don't know that I'm Pasta Gang. I haven't declared myself Pasta Gang, so therefore, I guess I don't know the secret pasta password or whatever.
Okay, that's another topic. Okay. Okay. All right. So there was. That's the paper. That's our sort of like we me and Dave chat every month, give or take, and. I think I'd like to recap at least my history dots of how robust first computing led to, I don't know, where I am now. And so actually maybe it's best, would you like to introduce like what robust first computing is, and then I could do the dots.
Okay,
to
sure
to,
yeah, yeah. I'll do it as quick as I can. The well
time.
I mean, not the actual crisp
Dave
quickest,
Dave
but,
is robust first, not efficiency, you know.
Well yeah, and people love to jab me about it because I go on and on about robustness versus efficiency, and the, you know, so one basic slogan is robustness, the ability to handle the unexpected, the ability to work in a wide variety of circumstances. Robustness requires redundancy, but efficiency eliminates redundancy. So robustness as a property, I mean, for machinery, we'd like our machines to be robust, but how you make them robust partly is you make them big and heavy, like the original VCRs that we had when we were kids, that we had when I was a kid, that are built like tanks. And you know, they weigh like 100 pounds and they're still working, versus the, by the end of the VHS era, you know, VCRs were being made out of tissue paper and you sneezed on them and they broke, but they were much more efficient, therefore they were much cheaper. And so when people say, oh yeah, yeah, my code is robust but it's efficient, or this machine, it's really, oh, it's robust, sure, but it's really efficient, you really can't have both. And in my experience, being a computer science professor for 25 years, in addition to being in computers ever since high school, there's this drumbeat of efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. We have to be efficient. The program has to be correct, of course. And then you have to make it as efficient as you possibly can. And I bought that. You know, uncritically, I tried to optimize my stuff. I wrote my code in assembler and saved one instruction and felt I was cool and all of that stuff. But eventually I started realizing that, you know, computers suck. Computers break. Computers crash. Computers get blue screen of death every time you sneeze at them. And, you know, if you've got a machine out in the world that's got some nice, like a gas pump, you know, and if the gas pump is not working, it's like the problem is always the computer. The problem is not the pump. The problem is not the lever that flips up to let the gas out. The problem is always something in the computer. And that's because I decided that computers have been made so efficient, they are incredibly fragile, incredibly brittle. And that's the underlying cause of all the security problems. Not all the security problems, but the vast majority of computer security failures are due to their design, which embraces efficiency to an unprecedented degree, and as a result produces fragility and brittleness to an unprecedented degree. And I wanted to fight against that. I wanted to say, is there another way to compute? And that's what led to robust first.
And so you call the like status quo of computing CEO computing, like CEO, right? Which obviously...
correctness and efficiency only.
Yes. And obviously this is also sort of like a little play on acronyms, play on words, that it's also like...
I guess, yeah, it's a acro pun or something, I don't know. Because of CEO and the sort of top-down control feelings that come with the idea of chief executive officer.
And so as far as I've understood it, like this you know, great challenge and task of robust first computing. Like, it has multiple things you have to do. If you want to find a better way of computing, there's like some technological challenges, like how do we program in this way? Like, what kind of hardware do we need? And maybe we'll get to that in a second, which is your like T2 tile project, where you're trying to build this a whole new computational stack.
That's the slogan. That's the slogan. I own it.
And but there's also another angle, which is, I would say, to do with like mentality around computing, you know, like, and sort of more of a political economic thing. Like, we're in this world that wants to do everything faster and more efficiently, so we can cut away things, and you know, we need to get to the point as fast as possible. It's, you know, like
right
yeah.
I think it's the same, that efficiencyizing purpose, the same, make these things more efficient, cut out the middleman, squeeze out the unnecessary parts, don't have any warehouses, get everything just in time. All of that, which reduces cost and does make it more efficient, also makes the system more fragile. If there's a middleman that has a warehouse, then even if the far end loses stock, the middleman can buffer. The middleman can still get you your loaf of bread. It might be yesterday's bread, but it's better than no bread at all, and so mm-hmm. on. And so, absolutely, I feel like the urge to make everything more efficient is way older than computers, and it's very important in the scheme of life, that if you are getting out competed by some other species that is a more efficient hunter or a more efficient user of the resources of land, then your species may go extinct. So there is this sense in which efficiency is bred into us, but I feel like we've taken it and we've got efficiency on steroids. We've got efficiency as crack. We've got we're addicted to the efficiency drug, even though it has all of these bad side effects, all these mm-hmm. bad consequences. And so I wanted to say, well, if we were going to try to go another way, what would it look like? As you say, what would programming look like? What mm-hmm. would software engineering look like? What would people programmers look like? And so
you know, okay, this is perfect. This is going exactly as I planned, which is maybe not very robust first, but like
whatever works.
there's lots of, just before I start joining some dots, because like I think maybe dear viewer or listener, maybe you noticing some links to Pastergang, but one thing I wanted to just cover before I start doing that is the robust first, is it a creed? Can you say the creed?
Sure. I believe it's called, how can I not have a T2 tile sitting right here? It's printed on the circuit board. I mean, I can get one out of the bag, but it would take a minute. The computational team creed, and it's first be robust, then be as efficient as possible, and then, I'm sorry. Oh, geez, I can't even say my own creed. Let me start again.
It's a robust first creed.
Yeah. First be robust, then be as correct as possible, and then as efficient as necessary.
Right. And this is just something I wanted to make sure that
we get that out of there.
Because it doesn't mean don't be efficient. It means be as efficient. If you need to be efficient, obviously you have to be. Right,
exactly. And as opposed to first be correct, then be as efficient as possible, and then as robust as necessary. Mm-hmm. That's the traditional mindset. That's the correct first mindset rather than the robust first, like that. And yeah, it's the same thing. So people mistake me. They think I'm anti-efficiency, and I am only anti-unmotivated efficiency. I'm only anti-efficiency that costs us robustness without getting us something that we actually need. So as efficient as necessary.
Yeah, and like I guess that's part of what you're doing currently with the, I know you don't want to call them the T3 tile, but
yeah, they're starting to turn into the T6 tile.
Oh my
because,
god!
Because the trademark of the company is Tensix, oh. T-E-N-S-I-X, and Tensix. In the code base they use the abbreviation T6
to
refer to the Tensix tiles, and so I've slipped into saying it myself. You know, out on the T6 tiles like that, and so you know, maybe I shouldn't be so wed to sequential numbering. Maybe that's a little small-minded. I mean, maybe T6 is next.
Maybe just skip a few. And I think the same is true with Pasta Gang. Like, if Noodle is infamously very inefficient and very, very bad in that sense. And so there have been points where, you know, like, people have rallied together and said, actually, no, we need to do... It's got to the point where we need to do something about this. And so it doesn't mean it's...
Need to speed it up in some particular way.
Yeah, to make it work on more people's devices so we can include more people.
So does Noodle deadlock all the time? Does Noodle hang all the time and you have to globally reset everybody's instance of Noodle? Is that a typical problem?
There's many issues. There's many issues. But there are people like... The nice thing is that people are actively working on making things more efficient within.
Well, browser. But I was pushing for more robustness. That you know, once you're doing distributed computing, it's easy to fall into these deadlocks and resource starvations and all these things like that. So that's why I was asking.
I see. There's another kind of error, another kind of issue. No, they happen all the time, and it's fine. You know, that's
right,
almost
because every that's part of the mantras that you guys talk about. That,
good bugs only, you know.
Right, that we shouldn't be so damn judgy. We should be happy judgy or whatever it is.
I mean, okay. So obviously, you're working on your distributed tiles project, and in a way, Pasta Gang has this sort of distributed computation going on as well with things like Noodle.
It's got multiple people, and if we're not going to say there's a conductor that all the people are supposed to be slavishly following, then that's a distributed computation according to the idea that we're all machinery.
Okay, so now that we've introduced a bit of that, or you have. So, like,
yeah, we will deftly segue.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to know how to like balance these sorts of things.
But... Yeah, the sort of places that we intended to go from where the conversation just keeps flopping along on its own is a little bit of a challenge.
I feel like there's like just things that we need to get out, and then it's like, okay, so like, I mean, so we call pretty much every month. So if you remember back, Dave, like you saw all of this happen in real time, but you may have forgotten, and the viewer may not know this at all. But I think was it a while back when I was doing a residency at Inkenswitch, I started to work on this very silly idea called the Taddy Web, which was like half parody and half thought experiment. For like, you know, like making computing better in a similar way to what you've been doing. And the idea of the Taddy Web is to try to like, you know, sort of identify that there are lots of ideas for making computing better, like robust first computing and many, many more, like local first, like permacomputing. And the Taddy Web is kind of like my sort of like I'm a measly research and residence trying to do the right thing, like how do I do all of these, like I really want to participate fully in all of these different things. How can I possibly do them all at the same time? Because it seems like if someone's into local first, that's like all they're into, you know. If and
right
so where I like tried, I don't know, like imagining lots of different ways of doing that, and did try lots of different ways of doing that. And one of the the sort of solutions, potential solutions that came up to me, like came to me, sort of came from robust first computing, which is, and I think I remember you were maybe like, it was inspired by specifically some things that you were doing with the T2 tiles. We were programming on them and you were trying to like make things die nicely at the time.
Oh, I remember that. Well, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. And because I thought like, if all I wanted was one potential solution to the Taddy web, which is doing everything, it's maybe not the only solution, but I was thinking I only need one. And one I could imagine for myself was being able to code and build machines in a way where I can very quickly get rid of them and build them again, right? Uh-huh. Like, as a sort of like, you know, a learning practice, like sort of realizing that I'm going to make so many mistakes and I need to be able to make those mistakes and recover from them and bounce back. And this is called the slippy mindset, which, and the term I used was like embrace death, you know, like.
I know, I saw the Taddy web happening out there. I didn't always understand it.
No, me neither.
This actually helps a little bit, what you just said, in that, you know, I do remember talking about death and the importance of death, because once, again, in the classic view of computing, the single thread of computation where it begins, the entire universe waits until the computation ends, and then the output of the computation is available, and that's it. There is no death except for the program ending. Whereas the instant we are dealing with distributed systems, then part of the system will die and the rest of the system has to keep on going. So now you have this question, how should I die?
How should I die? You know, yeah.
Should I die very rarely and reluctantly? Mm-hmm. Should I die at the first sign of any problem? And it seems from what you just said that you kind of took it in a direction, well, that one thing I should do is I should stay close to the floor so that I can build small programs that will do something. So I can throw them away and I can build them again because they're small, as opposed to building these giant edifices of hundreds of thousands of lines of code that if I were to throw all that away, I could not build it again easily.
Yeah.
And that maybe, and you know, and again, the world that we live in is these unbelievable towers of millions and billions of lines of code. It probably is billions these days, I don't know, that we live on top of. When we say, oh no, I just build on top of PHP or whatever it is, as if, you know, JSON or JavaScript isn't hundreds of millions of lines of code that we're building on top of.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple. It's good that we're recapping this stuff just for me and you as well.
Hey,
yeah,
always something new every time around.
Yeah, I guess there was like a number of reasons and why I thought it was good to build low to the floor, and that's like a nice metaphor actually. One of them was like, I was noticing that like the communities that were building things for some of these better computings, like Local First, were building like huge stacks of infrastructure that were specifically designed for Local First. And then, you know, and then I'd look at like IndieWeb and they were also doing the same thing, you know, like building these huge stacks. And they didn't really like, you know, they couldn't really, like, it was...
They're separate stacks.
They're separate stacks. So it was hard to interleave them and get this compatibility. But I thought like if things are lower to the ground, then it's much easier to say, oh, well, I'll just, you know, like hop across. And I guess the other reason for this, like, you know, embracing death mentality... by the way, the embrace death thing never really picked up.
Good. But... Well, I mean, I am pro-life a little bit in some way. Life and death go together, but their emphasis, you got to be careful about which way you want to go. I mean,
for sure.
Anyway,
yeah, and you know, like part of my thinking was that it was kind of edgy and it's sort of like a bit metal.
And that was my assumption.
But I think embrace death was like too far. And you know, but like spoilers, when I switched to saying let code die, people picked it up way more, right? So anyway, but
that's interesting. Yeah, embrace is something I do. Let code die is something code does.
Don't make code die, but let it die.
Yeah. Well, no, I think, you know, let code die is nice and short, really short. How many bytes is that? L-E-T space C-O-D-E space D-I-E. 12 bytes, let code die. That's pretty tight.
That's pretty good.
They're all doing work. The let is doing work, code is doing work, mm-hmm. and die is doing work. And
of course, the other thing to consider is that, we may get to this or not, but like the other thing to consider is that let code die came around because that was after we did all the natural code stuff. So embrace death. I didn't have this language right. about talking about natural code, which. And yeah, this is relevant, really, actually, because the other thing I was going to say was I viewed this challenge of, you know, like satisfying the Taddy Web challenge. I viewed it as, just like you do, not just a technological problem, but like a sort of anthropological problem.
Yeah, a social problem, a political problem, a people problem.
And a sort of like, you know, like if you could build a community that was doing that, then maybe you'd have more luck. But also like if it was a mantra I could tell myself, you know, like, you know, I'm getting frustrated at my computer and I'm like, no, I just need to embrace death. You know, like,
right.
So it's like introspective as well as a sort of anyway.
Yes.
So
fast forward.
I'm sort of like, I'm trying, you know, did about 12 months of embracing death. And that means like I was in this practice of like quickly spinning up new Taddy Web things, and one of the things I quickly spun up was I feel weird even saying that I spun it up or built it, because I think you know, as if that's a thing I should be ashamed of. It's like, oh no, it was actually so easy to do, you know, like, but that was the whole point, that it didn't,
It was close to the floor,
tiny little, put a wrapper around Flock, right? Uh-huh. This multiplayer client.
Right. Right. So yeah, you could just say you basically just described it differently, and then put a tiny little bit of code into making the difference there, and then boom.
It's like
not even that.
Yeah, I mean, like,
that's right. I made a link to it.
You're
welcome.
No, genuinely, it's just a link. And yeah, by that time, embrace death became let code die, I guess the other thing, the dot that I draw right now is that, you know, you talk about in robust first computing, there's concept of redundancy is very important, and obviously in Pastagang there is a lot of organizational redundancy, like I could disappear off the face
of
the earth.
One person can do it, but many mm-hmm. people are doing it, so mm-hmm. that's sort of definitionally redundant in some way, like that, even if the result wouldn't have been the same if one person had done it.
Yeah. And, you know, so that I think that, yeah, that's clearly another big theme there. But I think those are the initial dots.
Uh-huh. What I just thought at this absolute moment is the fact of how much I hate just holding forth on something, like giving a stand-up a lecture from zero, where I get no input from the world. I'm just supposed to show up and tell them crap, and mm-hmm. they're just supposed to sit there and listen to it. I mean, I do it, and I enjoy it sometimes when I do it, but I vastly prefer a conversation, mm-hmm. because then I don't know what's coming, and then the audience, the people in the conversation, They reveal themselves to me by what they say, and I reveal myself to them by what they say. And it feels to me like a much more interesting and a much more genuine experience than anything I can stand up and lecture about. And so now when I think about like Yo-Yo Ma getting on stage with his cello and playing a piece versus a bunch of jazz musicians getting together and jazzing, or Pasta Gang getting together and pastaing, whatever you call it, then it has that same flavor, that there's a chance to play off of different threads of execution, what's happening in your mind and body, what's happening in my mind and body, and so on.
Totally. And like, I think that's why sort of like joining in with this, like sort of, I don't know, becoming attached to the Algarve community, or basically being like a hopefully helpful, hopefully friendly bacteria on the Algarve.
Symbiote.
Yeah. It's why it's such a good match, I think, because like that's typically been the, like what people say about live coding in Algarve is that, you know, like the audience is like you know, affecting the sound, you know, the performer is bouncing back their energy to them. And yeah, I guess Pasta Gang takes it to a bit of a logical extreme, really, by like letting them literally change it as well.
I mean, that reminds me of I went during my, before I went to college, I spent 6 months, I spent about 2 months in London, in a hostel in Holland Park. And I, at one point, I went to a concert at Royal Albert Hall where Ravi Shankar was playing, and with his sitar and his group and so forth. And I knew a little bit about Ravi Shankar because I had an album, Ravi Shankar Live at Newport News, or something like that, one of the jazz festival things. And I don't know where I got it. I don't know where I got it. But the point is, as completely by luck, I was standing room only, way up in the nosebleed section of the thing, and I got the ticket for 60p or something, I don't know. And he played one of the songs from the album. He played one of the songs that I knew. And I actually recognized it. And I was like, holy crap, this is not just beow, beow, beow. You know, I actually, it's familiar to me. And yet it was totally different. And that's because Ravi Shankar, I guess the style of music in general, I really don't know anything about it, has an inherent intentional method, aspect of reflecting the environment that the performance is being played in. And so playing a piece of music, playing the exact same piece of music at an outdoor jazz festival in the sunshine versus playing it in Royal Albert Hall in an evening, the piece comes out totally differently just because it's being played in a different place. And I thought that, wow, you know, geez, that, what does the composer think about that? I have to think, no, this is the style of music. And I thought it was very cool.
Huh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting.
And I don't even really know how true it is. I mean, anybody that knows anything about Indian music could obviously say, well, actually, and then explain it all to me.
But, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I mean, like, there is something about, like, when things are so live that you can't possibly do it the same way twice.
Right. Yeah. And that's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah. And, you know, like, that's, to me, that's like a sign of adaptability and robustness, you know?
Versus you know, an actor performing a script. Now, even if every performance, if you go to a Broadway show or whatever it is, you could argue that every performance is unique in some way or something like that. It might be that the way it hits the audience is not that different, unless something goes wrong or unless there's an understudy or whatever. But in other forms, I mean, to me, the classic is, you know, like a pop singer versus a stand-up comedian. The pop singer goes to concert, they have to sing their hit exactly the same way every single time, or the audience will riot. And stand-up comedian has to come up with absolutely new stuff every single time, or else the audience will riot. And so there's like a spectrum there.
But that is interesting, because like stand-up comedy is one of these things that is why it's such a, like a cursed art form, because it takes a long time to build up material.
Yeah, and then poof.
And then it's gone. You like do a TV special and it's like, yeah, it's all gone.
Right. Oh, well, and then of course in the era of cell phones, every performance is a TV special. Yeah. That was Chris Rock's complaint, that he could no longer go out and try material out because it would always get recorded, it would always get spoiled. And so he could never build up a set of stuff so that he could do a show.
I mean,
that's it.
This is like the, I guess, privilege of like being able to perform something with no preparation, an improv performer, right? For example, you know, they practice a lot, but like actually doing two shows versus one show, there's like no difference in the amount of practice you need to do, you know, two different shows.
Right. Well, they're all different, but of course,
they all suck.
Improv, the most hated form of entertainment.
Right.
because, you know, say anything you want, say anything you want. Did you say, fire me?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I say that. Former comedy improv performer, it sucks. But
but again, and this, you know, truth versus quality. That you know, if I'm responding like in a conversation like we're responding here, I'm just trying to react to what you're saying. You're just trying to react to what I'm saying. We're not reading from a script. You're checking your bullet points from time to time. But even then, most of the time we're just going along, like that. In the improv, that's all there is. I'm supposed to be reacting to. But when it's scripted, the quality, the funniness can be made so much more concentrated. Mm-hmm. Cut out all the ahs and the ums, just like your description of our paper before we edited the dialogue with all of the mistakes and everything in it like that. You know, that's truth. That's what we actually said. But quality boils it all down and makes it still sound like it's a dialogue, but it's a much better dialogue than we ever actually had.
Right. Yeah. And I'm actually really pleased you mentioned that, because I guess that's another like big part of Pasta Gang, is being willing to sacrifice quality for what they call energy, you know, like
I like that. I think, you know, rather than for you know, ease of construction. Higher quality, easier to construct. But see, that sounds like a trade-off. But you know, higher
quality, also true,
more energy. No, that's great. I like that.
But it is true. It is easier. Like I go to these monthly algorithms events, and like I just rock up and plug in and do the loop.
Yeah,
and
right.
some people have like spent the previous month preparing, and then as soon as it finishes they start preparing for the next one, and I'm like, wow, I don't know how to do that, let alone have time for it. But
well,
so it's very impressive.
And it can be great, and for all I know, someone like that could be the backbone of the piece, of a big chunk of the time of one given concert, you know, whatever it is, which is great. But again, the bigger picture seems to be that you want to have room for both. You want to have room for you to just show up and plug in and go, wah!
Yes.
And room for the guy saying, now the 17th movement.
No, absolutely. Like I do find it just quite humorous for some reason, like the sort of different experiences different people have of these events, you know, like it's like, oh, wow, yeah, this is, oh, that sounds really hard. It's great though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I confess I've only listened to bits and pieces of Pasta Gang. But the point is, I mean, I don't listen to that much music, and I don't listen to club or gays or snows or peas or schmooze or whatever the current kind of music is. But I do see that if you just, once a beat is going, You know, you can just do that, and then you can kind of wait until you can think of something else. And it definitely feels like there are no mistakes, there are no wrong notes. If you just go ahead and go with it, and as long as the beat is there, and you can change the beat every so often, you need to change the beat every so often. But it seemed to me, and maybe this goes to the energy thing. Maybe it, once you got the beat going, it does make it easier to create from a standing start versus like a stand-up comedian who's got no driving rhythm. I mean, sometimes they do. Sometimes you get a whole piece that it keeps coming back to, oh, I don't get no respect, or whatever the mantra, whatever the tagline is that the guy uses over and over.
Oh, this may be the perfect segue. There was there was a couple other things. I think there's probably two other things if you've got the time.
If you got the beer.
I'll send it over. Don't hold your breath. Okay. So one of the other things was mantras. And mantras are a huge part of Pastagang. And you can root it back to a Roost, this tool I made. Because basically, if people don't know, the first Pastagang client had one mantra at the top, which was normalize sharing scrappy fiddle, scrappy fiddles.
Hey, I like normalize scrapping sherry fiddles.
Whatever it is. Yeah. And I guess started using that mantra. I'd never really used a mantra before.
Wait a minute. You're saying that you got normalized from somebody else's code? You didn't put it into somebody else's code?
No, so basically, when I made this flock wrapper to start with,
I see.
I was like, oh no, wait, I can't do this because then people... It will think that it's flock. I see, that
it's supposed to be good and whatever.
Yeah, well, like, no, it was more like I didn't want to sort of make it seem like it was deceitful. Like it was like basically the website, I was like, great, I made it. Oh, wait, it looks exactly the same as flock. Right. People are going to get confused. And so I thought I need to put something at the top.
Some little distinguishing thing.
Oh, and maybe I could make it like a bit jokey. Maybe it could be like a marquee, you know, like a...
Sure,
and I was like, what could I put on the marquee? I don't know. I'll just use my mantra that I always use.
Okay, right? All right. So you already came in with normalized sharing scrappy fiddles.
Yes. Yeah. Now, of course, you know, like fast forward and people paid way more attention to that mantra than I expected. And so... other people went ham with it and put in loads of mantras, and they're this big part of the community now. But the reason I made that mantra for a Roost back in the day, very bite inefficient mantra, by the way, but
lovable just because of that.
Right.
So long, normalized.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But like I said, it was the first sort of mantra that I picked up. And I picked up this mantra practice. I thought I'd try it because you have always been full of mantras, absolutely full of mantras. And that's, so like, maybe people don't know that it sort of roots... those are the dots, you know? Those are the dots.
Well, and then to me, a mantra is a small code transmission like that. And so now we're like back to efficiency or something like that. You know, how can you get at something in very few bytes, literally? Like let code die. That's why I counted how big it was. That's a tiny code transmission that has a potentially great number of effects and so on and so forth. And so, yeah, I mean, I've been trying to make up slogans. At least since high school or college or something like that. And certainly in college, I finally started making a list of them. So I have a slogans file.
Do
slogans.
You?
Text. No way. Oh, yeah.
Just like Pastagang has mantras dot something.
Uh-huh. Well, there you go. And the whole point is, if you have some big insight, that at least seems like a big insight at the moment, make a slogan out of it to help remember it, like that. And
right,
so,
right.
For example, one of my favorite slogans, which was not invented by me, but by my friend Pete, the slogan is, sloganize. and you
That's
know
great.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great.
And that has absolutely helped. It's and so that's why I've got all these little things that tend to pop out of my mouth when I'm listening to somebody and then it just comes out. So
we are coders.
Exactly. I mean, there was one that popped out just in conversation like three social networks ago, where somebody was talking about the distinction between code and data, and they were saying, I am too familiar with Wittgenstein to believe there will ever be clear distinction between code and data. And my reply, which was just, I pulled it right out of my butt, was I hadn't have this before. I hadn't already read it ahead of time. It was not scripted. It was, well, there's one fundamental notion. If simplicity is finally best, code is data in motion. Data is code at rest. Like that. And I think it had a significant germ of truth. Data is data in motion, and data is code
in rest.
At rest. At rest, yeah.
Like that. That's super interesting.
And again, it's another aggravating circular definition, which I am famous for, and make no apologies. I will get down with anybody who wants to say that's circular.
But it's not. It's like a mantra or a slogan is a symbol for something else, though, isn't it? It's like, let code die is not like, does not contain all the information you need. It points to,
it's a pointer. It's as talked about in the paper, it's a symbol, a symbolic pointer, and so forth. And part of what we want when we sloganize is to make new pointers that are self-reading, that even if someone has never heard them before, they will get a useful impact out of it.
Right.
I mean, because a slogan could just be slogan 94. Oh, good one. Oh, slogan 87. Oh, hey, great. Like that. But someone who's never heard them gets nothing out of it. So the game is to try to pick the smallest number of bytes that will produce a sound utterance, a transmission that if someone knows the language that the thing is based on, they will get some of the effect, and that will allow them an entry point into this much more complicated thing, the Pasta Gang, the Toddy Web, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah. I guess it's like it helps if a symbol gives a hint to what it's, representing, like an icon on your computer. You know, the bin button probably is a symbol. That's not the actual bin.
Exactly. And people joke about that all the time. The floppy disk symbol. Hey, that looks like a floppy disk. And that the important point was that it can help people get started. If people just see it and they have no clue, they might be able to figure it out. Whereas if it just was hex FEBA 77000, then they would not be tempted to click on it or whatever.
Yeah, and I guess this does bring me to the other point. There's another point I've sacrificed, I think, for time, but let code die, And so because with mantras for me, like a lot of the purpose of it is to remind myself of things. Something I can say to myself, under my breath. And so it was interesting to hear you saying the same thing with your slogans.
Like that. just to try to summarize a worldview, summarize a perspective, so that we won't lose it, and we can perhaps, and it always helps if they're kind of funny in some little way,
if they
have some little niftiness to them that makes
why
them
not?
Because another one of the slogans is be memorable. That if you want to pick one thing to go for, what you should do is be memorable. Like that.
Maybe we should add some of these.
And having a little twist to it, making it a little punny, or making it rhyme, or making it extremely short, or having a good meter, all those things can help a bit of code be memorable.
Yeah, that's cool. And the other thing I really like about sort of like the concept of a list of slogans or mantras is that it's not just your own. You can sort of collect them up, you know, like, so you collected up sloganize and
right.
You know, also in Pasta Gang's mantras, there's like energy, yes, quality, no, which comes from someone else. I don't even know who did
it. So what exactly is it? Just energy, or is it?
Energy, yes, quality, no.
Ah, okay. Got it. Perfect. energy over quality.
Yes. But the key part of it is that yes is in capitals and no is in capitals as well.
You know? Right. Yeah.
Me and many other people have discovered it through someone called Lucy Cheeseman, who is
heard the name.
Yeah, not on social media, but she didn't come up with it. She sort of passed it on from someone else, I think. But anyway,
pass on the energy stuff.
Yeah, I should just look up the, because I do this conversation like so many times. I'm like, yeah, I don't know where. I'm just really bad at remembering
after
names.
After two or three times, maybe it would be better.
I should just
to
look it up.
Write it down. Yeah,
but yeah, she is not the creator of that mantra, but she is a
popularizer.
A popularizer of that mantra. Yes. But this is the thing. Like, so with mantras, it's, you know, for me, it's something that you sort of say to yourself to help yourself remember.
Yes.
And so I guess like the final, like, you know, to wrap some of this up, like the earlier we started by talking about machines, right?
Yep.
And I guess like one way of viewing Pasta Gang is like as a sort of big machine, you know, this big weird multi-headed monstrosity organism,
right.
And
constantly evolving, bits falling off, other bits getting pasted on all the time.
Yeah, and,
sure.
And I guess these like mantras, you know, is a way for the machine to tell itself what to do in a way.
Yes.
Yeah, and I guess if you had any thoughts about that, and B,
I think,
are you part of the machine? That's the question. Then.
Well, a part of the machine. The is doing a lot of work there. I mean, it's I'm a part of many, many machines like that, and proud to be part of some and less proud to be part of others, depending on the circumstances. But for sure. The talking to yourself, or Pasta Gang as a collective entity talking to itself, that is how, well, I hate to say it, we keep code alive, is by repeating it. And we repeat it to ourselves, we repeat it to each other, we knock on the door saying, have you heard the good news about Pasta Gang? you know, or whatever it happens to be, to spread the word. And, you know, for me, it goes to how does code preserve itself? And, you know, the code preserves itself by getting to be transmitted. Data has to turn into code and get transmitted somewhere, and so on. So we're all talking to ourselves. We all have these things. And you know, and again, if you now pop up and say the Lou and Dave conversation as a single machine, which is running, it's a weird machine. It's like a dotted line. It runs for 1 hour a month like that. And then it turns into other machinery like that. It has that same thing. thing. And as we started out today, we were starting to recapitulate the talk, recapitulate things that came from before, and so on and so forth. But each time we do that, we streamline it, we you know, we tune it up, we apply it to the local circumstances, and that's as it should be.
That's cool. That's interesting. You know, I don't know if I should, but I kind of always enjoy the slightly psychedelic and body horror things about things like Pasta Gang, and also, like, you know, the Natural Code, like, we are all the machines, like the machine. That's definitely, I think, one thing that, like, robust first computing and, like, AlgoRave have in common is they both love repetition. And that's, like, a classic AlgoRave mantra. We love repetition, you know?
Right. Right. Well, and again, it's the efficiency mindset. Mm-hmm. Like from Talking Heads, say something once, why say it again? Like that, where that was just be totally silly, coming from somebody who's singing a song with a chorus. It's all about repetition, and so on, and carrying the code into new contexts. You can't step in the same context twice. So by repeating the code, you're repeating it in a different context, even if it's just it's the 17th repetition, not the 16th repetition. Maybe that's not a lot different, but it's a little different. And again, if it's too different, then it's not going to serve its purpose. People are going to stop listening. So if you want the code to survive, again, you don't have to. You can let the code die. But, you know, put it this way. Part of what let code die has is a presumption that the code exists. Like that. And so that implicitly says make code then let it die like that. And a lot of people don't think they're making code. A lot of people think they're just living in the world and stuff is being done to them. Let code die is empowering like that, I think, in that sort of backhanded way.
Right. Like let code die, but like, wait, I don't have any code and I need to let code die.
Exactly. How do I get started? Well, maybe I should make something just to let it die. And then you're off in a good direction. That's a good way to come at it. I'm only writing this in order to throw it away.
That's interesting. That is quite interesting. Yeah. And transmitting code in an AlgoRave setting, like you're obviously typing stuff, but you're also like transmitting code, as in like the sounds coming out, you know, it's something you're transmitting quite literally. And it's like really different to this classic concept of software engineering where you're like, no, we will write the code and then it is done. And there's we're not thinking about any transmission at all, you know, like
deployment. That's somebody else's problem. And I love the idea. I mean, I've never really done anything like the live coding stuff, but I love the idea of just closing the loop and thinking it up, writing it, debugging it, and shipping it, and getting reactions from the world all at once. It's a wonderful thing.
I'm
completely chicken about it, and I'm not going out in the world, so I don't know that I would ever do it, but yeah, we'll see.
You will see. I mean, like, it was fun when I was at ICL, and we should probably finish, but
yeah, we gotta figure out a way to bring this in for a landing here, Lou.
Yeah, okay. Let me see what I can do. But one of the fun things that when I went to ICLC, which is the International something or other for live coding
conference,
yeah, and I did a workshop about CellPond, which is as you know, based on like the robust first kind of architecture where it's all super random and so on and spatial-ish. I put forward that it was live in the sense that it was literally a living system, you know, like And that actually goes even further than other live coding things, you know, because it is alive, you know.
So it's not just being used in a lifelike way. It is on itself a lifelike thing that I'm now using in a lifelike way. So
yeah, I haven't really sort of reflect, like, I'm still sort of like letting it sink in, like, how I feel about that. But
It might be certainly good to come back in the bigger picture of the life at many levels, and it's not one or the other, it's both, and all that kind of stuff. And so then you know, yes, the answer is always yes, and like that. Well, you know, I don't know if this made any sense, but if anybody listens to it out there, I hope it was fun in some respect anyway. I certainly enjoyed having the conversation.
Yeah, let us know what you think. And viewer, what listener, you should make your own Pastor Gang podcast episode. Look,
there you go.
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, and how do you do that? How do you do that? Yeah, I mean, yeah, where do I question. Send it? Two box tops? What does it take?
My headphones are telling me they're running out of battery, so...
There you go. Technological means.
To do that, I think go on to pastorgang.cc, the website, and then look at the how to contact Pastor Gang, and they'll help you out, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Well, Dave, I think you are part of Pastor Gang now. I'm so sorry to be the bringer of bad news, but...
Hey, it is what it is.
All right.
I feel like, hey, that must make me cool.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does.